You're listening to Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're here at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, home of Heritage Radio Network. Quick note, our sponsor today is Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market reminds you that every bite has a story. Whether it's a tomato, a muffin, or a T-bone steak, your conscious food choices can change the planet. Because at Whole Foods Market, every single purchase helps us support things like animal welfare, organic agriculture, equitable trade, and energy offsets. Let's think before we eat. Let's retake our plates. Check out WholeFoodsMarket.com and Whole Foods NYC. That's the Twitter hashtag. I did not know they had a Twitter. That's our awesome sponsor today. Speaking of foods, we have a couple of experts here on that subject. They're both gainfully unemployed, apparently, but they are both veteran food writers, cookbook authors, and they actually recently published cookbooks in the last year that were nominated for various awards, including the James Beard Awards, which is coming up really soon. So we have Peter Kaminsky. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here.
He's the co-author of Seven Fires, Grilling the Argentine Way. That's the book that came out last year I mentioned. He's also author of Pig Perfect. He's a producer of, the upcoming...
The Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, honoring Paul McCartney at the White House June 2nd.
Exciting stuff.
Yeah.
And you have an upcoming book, too, next year?
Yeah, shortly after I finish it.
Yeah.
It's called Culinary Intelligence, A Hedonist's Guide to Healthy Eating.
I can't wait for that one. That sounds very intelligent. Also, Peter Meehan, that is, we have on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Cool. So Peter has co-written Momofuku, the cookbook, with David Chang. He writes various other... books.
Stuff.
He co-wrote the cookbook for Frankie Spintino, which is going to come out soon.
In June. We got a nice blurb on it from Peter Kaminsky.
Okay, there you go. So what is it like co-writing these books with chefs?
I think when you finish a book, at the end of the process, you always say that you're never going to do it again. Mm-hmm. And then you find yourself back at it again. I mean, you've done it more times than I have.
Do they at least feed you well in the process?
I think if you're going hungry when you're writing a cookbook, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
But you've co-written more cookbooks than I have. What brings you back to the...
Well, I work with chefs who I really like. I love food. And, you know, great chefs all have a different take on things. So it's interesting thing. It's interesting just to see that. Most of the stuff I write is in the voice of the chef, and I find that interesting. It's ghostwriting in a sense, although you have to give structure to it. And I was a National Lampoon editor and writer for 4 years, and I describe trying to get the voice of somebody who you're writing for. It's like parody without the jokes. So mm-hmm. In a sense, it's easier. When their wife or, you know, husband or boyfriend or whatever says, you know, I feel like they're talking, then I feel I've done the job and I enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think the thing, I know for the books that I've done, I feel like I've been very close with the people that I've done it with, and that it's a product of friendship and it's something that you're doing together, and it's nice to have a partner in a project. You know, I don't think I would co-write a cookbook or write a cookbook for someone that I didn't have a personal relationship with, because I don't think it would be satisfying in the same way to try to honing in on a voice that you didn't have that much invested in.
Right. So it's more genuine than this kind of channeling the cook's voice. And
yeah, I mean, I think you try to make it as genuine as possible. And, you know, there's all kinds of techniques you use for that. I mean, I don't know how you work, Peter, but, you know, some of, like Dave Chang for Momofuku, Dave can write. So there was stuff that he wrote that we worked on, kind of like a writing project. And then there was interviews and, you know, transcribing that and turning that into, and then, you know, weaving it all together into like one cohesive piece.
That's interesting. I was just thinking about Francis Malman, who I did the Argentina book with, is a very good writer. He's won a number of Spanish literary prizes. In fact, I think, Kathy, you read one of his erotic pieces.
He definitely can write some really good erotic poetry. Yeah. And it's a lot of fun.
the thing about Francis, who is a writer, he couldn't write this book in English, because if you have this Spanish style, and he speaks very good English, but if you have this Spanish style, it tends to be more formal, more literary, more poetic in a sense. So we took some of his stuff, actual writings, and reset them as lines of poetry, which, you know, they kind of read at, they read that way. But other guys like Daniel Boulud or Michel Richard, they have an outlook on the world and a way they express themselves and a certain sense of humor and a certain sense of aesthetic. And I think you just don't want to run the tape recorder and let that go, because it's not going to work. It needs to read on the page, or it needs to read in your sound in your mind as you imagine they would be if they were speaking to you. But if they spoke to you, it would be a different language.
Yeah, I was kind of imagining. I mean, so did these folks actually write down what they wanted, and then you kind of edited it, polished it, translated it in your case? Or I was kind of imagining you were like just, you know, hanging out with Francis and in Argentina and taking notes. And
that's what it was.
Yeah. And you managed to get a lot of really. I'm looking for this one quote about burntness. It was like,
oh,
this
it's
really
about
great...
how it's. I can find it.
Okay, the tomatoes.
Why don't you and Peter talk about the rest of our lives? And...
So I didn't know that. So David Chang is a pretty good writer. You'd think, like, you know, when you have the co-writer, the latter person did all the work. But in this case, no.
It was. I mean, I think that book could have come out with just Dave's name on the front of it. You know, it's first person, it's Dave's story, it's a lot of stuff about, you know, Momofuku, which is all his thing. Yeah. But we tried to approach it as a creative project together and to work on everything together. And he also had a lot of input and ideas. He's a cookbook reader, so he had opinions about the way things would work. You know, even through design, he was very involved with, you know, all the stages and making it happen in a very authorial way. So he's not illiterate, which I think is unusual among chefs, but, you know.
It kind of sounds like this book is written so frank, and it sounds like up close and personal, like he's talking. Like this one excerpt about chicharrones. Chicharrón to start the meal. I'm sure some people saw it as a little fuck you to kick off an $85 menu, and I can't say that there wasn't some of that in serving a fried pork rind to start a fancy dinner. It's not an amuse bouche in the traditional sense. So he's just really, like, you know, very, as people, you know him, he's kind of notoriously
candid.
Yeah. And you really and I guess he writes that way too.
Yeah, and some of that, I mean, I think he would have taken more of the fucks out of the book than I wanted him. You know, he was into cleaning it up at the end, but I tried to preserve a lot of that. You know, because that is part of how we at least talk to each other. And when Dave's telling, you know, when I'm talking to him and we're talking about these things, it sounds like that. So, you know, that was the sound that I was trying to capture. And that's also the way that he writes. It's pretty, there's not a lot of layers of filtering, you know, on the...
I was going to say, I think Peter Meehan made a good point there about, you know, it's not important if your name's on the cover of the book. I mean, in a funny way, these guys are much more successful, certainly much more affluent than we are, we writers. But if we've had bylines in the Times and in Food and Wine and in New York and stuff over the years, outside of the town they come from, more of the country is going to know your name than theirs. So, you know, publishers often want it on it, but, you know, it wouldn't matter to me, you know, that much if my name wasn't on these books.
Wow, that's pretty. How about, what do you think of that, Meehan? Would you agree? It's not.
At the end of this project, I was stoked that my name was going to be on the cover. Like, I was happy with the product. I was proud of it, and that was exciting for me because I think it's the book that I'm most happy to have worked on, and I felt really involved in it. But to some extent, yeah.
The ego part is all I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. I don't need it on there for that. And, you know, it's just more at the end. I was really happy that, you know, proud of what we'd done together, and I was really proud to have my name on it. But yeah, it's not essential. And I don't see my name as much of a brand, but I see how it could become that. You know, like, this is the first kind of big cookbook, or like cookbook,
this is a really big cookbook
that seems to be doing well. Like, so, you know, maybe that could happen going forward, but.
And I should note, too, to anybody listening who's not holding these cookbooks, that they're more than a cookbook. I mean, they're this, you know, as fat as, I don't know, an inch or so wide, and they're full of reflections on everything, absolutely everything. And of course, great photos. So it's not, you know, just Momofuku, you know, photos, boom, recipe. It's roasted rice cakes here. There's like a whole like reflection on Koreans, kids who are eating them. You know, it goes on. And of course, you know, Seven Fires, my favorite part was like the really lucid prose that brought the photos to life. So well done.
And I wonder if they're also great because they're the last of their kind. Are these beautiful, you know, heavily illustrated chefs or heavily photographed chefs' cookbooks in part happened because you needed to get enough into a book so that you could charge the money for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people enjoyed going away in these books. But I really wonder with the internet has become, well, it is not more and more pervasive. It's here everywhere. How much people are going to want to spend time and money they're going to want to spend on books like these when they can find recipes on the net? I mean, if I buy some new ingredient that I want to cook, I'll often look on the internet and, you know, look for three or four recipes and triangulate into a way that seems cool. So I hope we last, and I hope we keep getting advances.
Do you think you could do this kind of work on the internet, though? Like have a site that, no?
Yeah. Well, I'm like a turtle with no legs. I mean, like, I am so slow. You know, like, I need to write books because that's about how often I can miss a deadline but make it by close enough to have something come out. So I feel like books are just like, that's as fast as I can go. I love what people do on the internet, but I don't know that I could do, I don't know that I could translate what we did in that to a format on the internet that would have work the same way.
Interesting. It does seem like it reflects a different pace. These books, it's something you can just kind of enjoy, savor, have on your bedside table and just not worry about, you know, all the things that people are worrying about when they're clicking around on, you know.
Yeah, and I'm still goofy for books. I mean, I buy records.
Me too.
And so, you know, that's like, I still want books. I still like having books. I still like that physical presence, you know. And I think people are still buying cookbooks. For some reason, you know, cookbook sales are okay.
Yes.
You know, it's not as hard hit as other categories. So there's something about, you know, the very physical thing of cookbooks that people haven't given up on yet. I mean, I guess that's probably coming.
But. Yeah, I just wonder where it's going exactly. You know, I also think, I wonder what you all think. When you buy a cookbook, if you take one recipe out of it and make it your own, I mean, in other words, it becomes part of your life.
Your repertoire, yeah.
Then that's a cookbook well bought. I mean, no one makes 10 recipes from a cookbook.
My rule of thumb back in the day was 3 recipes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, make 3 things that came out well. Obviously, if you get one that sticks with you forever, that's great. But, I mean, I find myself when I buy cookbooks, I cook a lot of stuff out of them. You know, give kind of kick the tires on it. See where, you know.
Sure.
See if it's going to, like, hang around and be useful. So.
So that's the initial stage. You know, cook everything, as many things as strike your fancy, and then you kind of realize that there's one or two that really stick with you. You want to make it every day.
Yeah, it depends. Certain, you know, different cookbooks, different ways. I mean, like those Fergus Henderson cookbooks are just like everything I cook out of it is I love his recipe.
Yeah.
You know, his recipe, mm-hmm. right? And the whole experience of doing it feels like, you know, kind of going on a trip. Like, I love the way that those recipes work.
Well, you know, I was
other books. Yeah, it's like kind of easy, and you work it into your, you know, into your repertoire with other things.
Yeah, Fergusness. Speaking of which, I was talking to someone. in the last few days. And, you know, if you say, who's the most influential chef in the world? Sort of the common wisdom these days is more likely than not, if they're in the food world, they're going to say Ferran Adrià and Il Bulli. But if I think about what's happening in the world of food and gastropubs and the way we like to eat versus fine, you know, white tablecloth fine dining, I would say Henderson and what he's done and what he stands for. And for the audience, he's this wonderful guy who owns a place called St. John in London. He staked out his turf nose to tail eating. Just don't waste any part of an animal. Although I've never had a fingernail omelet. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think Fergus is...
I had a fingernail dumpling.
I would call him...
You've had one, Peter?
Fingernail dumpling.
Oh,
but please continue.
Nice.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh, dude. No.
But Henderson, if I had to say, like,
calcium?
Here's the influential guy in where food has gone in the last 5 or 6 years, it'd be much more him than Ferran.
Well, I mean, I think Ferran's influence is so pervasive and you know, everything he's done since 1994 has colored so many of the trends that kind of trickle down. But I think Fergus is the guy who's, like, the Velvet Underground or something, like, just so people are emulating it, people are doing it, people are taking what he kind of put out there and putting their own spin on it. But when you go back to those books, I mean, I haven't been to London, I haven't been to the restaurants, but when I go to those books and I cook from it and I read from it, I feel like, you know, you're plugging into something that's like a really strong force.
And Ferran's like Karl Marx and Jesus, you know, don't judge him by his followers.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a real...
he's amazing.
Genius of a person.
Yeah.
I also think that's an interesting comparison, because I think that Ferguson's the nose-to-tail philosophy, that's a lesson that everyone can kind of latch onto. It's not restricted to having incredible skill or technique, like, you know, all this, you know... get molecular gastronomy that Ferran Adrià is known for. It's a little more universal, I guess.
Well, it's more accessible.
It's more accessible.
The home chef. Although
it's challenging in the same way, you know,
yeah.
if you go as far as he's gone, you know, there's an austerity to it.
Good
that
word.
I think is apart from most home cooking, and then the trotter gear, you know. The man cooks with a lot of pig's feet. I mean, he's... Everything has that unctuousness. You know?
I love the photo, you know, the fly leaves and the end papers and nose to tail. It's got one, it's, you know, the classic tattoo of the heart with mother on it and an arrow through it, except it's a photo of a pig's heart with a real arrow through it and mother written on it. So he's a take no prisoners carnivore.
And that's the thing. If you get those books, you have to get the British edition that Bloomsbury put out, because those are those little white ones that are really
I haven't even seen anything else but
they're American editions, but they're not published with the same
The Stieg Larsson book.
Check it out,
you know, Stieg Larsson, the girl, you know, the dragon tattoo and all, and the girl with in Swedish it's the man who hated women, not the girl with the dragon tattoo.
So we're going to come back and hopefully talk a little bit more about what these folks like to cook with after our musical break. This song was selected by Peter Kaminsky. And what is it again?
It's The Barnyard Dance by Martin Bogan and Armstrong.
Let's do it. Let's Eat In. We just had to cut that little Barnyard Dance a little short, but certainly
go to
it sounds.
Get it? It's one of the cutest songs ever. It's about a party that the vegetables have, a drunken party.
A drunken party that the vegetables have.
So it's called The Barnyard Dance by Martin
when
Bogan
nobody's
and
looking.
Armstrong.
Love it. Thanks, Peter. That was Peter Kaminsky, food writer, author, co-author of Seven Fires, Grilling the Argentine Way, one of our guests today. And our other guest is Peter Meehan, co-author of also many cookbooks, most recently Momofuku with David Chang, and coming up soon, Frankie Spuntino, which was excellent. I got to get a sneak peek at it. Thanks for sending that.
Oh, nice.
Cool. It looks really cool. And I can't wait to make the recipes really soon. Today's show is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. I would like to thank Jack Inslee, engineer, producer, and engineer Nat Wiener from Heritage Radio Network, which you're listening to. So I just wanted to talk. We're getting on topic about all these influential restaurant chefs and cookbook authors. I wanted to take it back to simpler times, maybe, and see what you guys like to cook at home. If you're ever, you know, just have the time that it's outside of work, does that ever happen? Or
I cook every day, pretty much. Yeah. I love to cook. I like, there's two things in the world I like to do where I don't look at a clock. It's fishing and cooking. So I'm not one of those, you know, three-step restaurant recipe guys. I love to cook. So pretty much doesn't matter what. I like borscht. I like roast chicken. I like, been doing a lot of stuff because it's this time of year before the real greens come in, or the real veggies. I've been doing a lot of pasta with kale and with chard, and now I've started doing some, you know, some things with fava beans and a little bit of bacon. I do everything with bacon.
Yeah.
I want a reason why things shouldn't have bacon rather than why they should, but
it's pretty much everything's better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I had a kid 4 months ago, and I've barely gone out to eat since then. So it's mainly been cooking at home. I cook stuff out of that book.
Wow.
I cook stuff out of the Frankie's cookbook just to make sure, you know, it's gone to print, but you're still like, what if that's not right?
Is the red cabbage salad in the Frankie's book?
No, sir. It's a prime meats dish, I guess.
I see.
I cook at home all the time, try to cook a couple times a day.
Well, congrats. It must be so busy with having a little one newly arrived.
She's pretty patient with it.
Yeah.
And you cook too, pretty much most of the time, don't you?
I do, yeah. You know, I try to sneak it in every now and then. And I feel like I'm torn between a few different kitchens right now, which is interesting. I have ingredients all over the place. But it's just my favorite thing to do is to go to the Green Market, like right after the show. I'll probably hop over there and just see what's around. It's a fun time, I think, this time of the year to just kind of stock it and see what's new. Friday there was these beautiful flowering greens. I haven't seen too much else. I'm still, you know, waiting for the real stuff.
Good word, stalking it. You know, do you know Russ Parsons? Russ is the food editor of the LA Times, and he's written wonderful stuff about farming issues and vegetables and fruits. But we were talking lately about when many people go to the farmer's market, they sort of feel they fulfilled their, you know, Lacovoire sustainable social contract just by going and shopping, you know, buying there.
Uh-huh.
He said, but he thinks people, and I tend to agree, kind of treat it like a supermarket. You want tomatoes, you go in, you go to the first place that's got them, and you fill up your shopping bag. Whereas, you know, green markets like the one we have in Union Square have farmers from southern New Jersey up through New England. Things come into flower and into season at different times. And I think one of the things that gets lost in just going and, you know, making a shopping list and filling it out at the first available stand is you should, as you say, stalk the green market and suss it out. And, you know, if the tomatoes are in from southern Jersey, dollars of donuts, they're not in from the Catskills yet. And, you know, you really need to test out your ingredients and look and get seduced by them. And that's one of the great pleasures of, I think, of urban foraging.
It is a pleasure, yeah. And have you found anything especially fetching lately?
Yeah. I don't know who these two kids, they're probably, you know, older than anybody here, but anyway, they're younger than me. But they have these tan, wholesome, blonde farmer tans and a big smile, and they're at Cadman Plaza in Brooklyn. And I just love their stuff. And they had these baby kale, which I've been cooking with for 2 weeks.
Baby kale.
Yeah.
Just regular kale, not Tuscan, not...
No, not Tuscan. It's just regular old kale, only it hadn't
just
gotten...
Just tiny, like, little curly...
And so you can eat the whole thing.
Wow, that sounds yum. Wow.
Cool. Yeah, good stuff. You know the Gorzinski farm up at Union Square?
Which one? No.
The guy with, like, the huge beard and the really dirty weeds and the, you know... it was Gorzinski Organic Farm until you had to pay to get organic certification.
And he
was so pissed about it, he called it Gorzinski Ornery Farm. changed the name. But they always have good... I don't know. I got some, like, really baby broccoli rub from there on Saturday that was...
Oh, and there's like, little cauliflowers now?
Yeah, just, like, yeah, just the first buds of that, you know, like what you were talking about, flowering green. So, I don't know. That's been killer. I'm kind of waiting. Yeah, I'm ready for things to... keep making their way into the market, but the thaw has come, you know. It's not just like apples and potatoes
and anymore. The ramps have been really nice,
but the ramps, the price of the ramps, I mean, I love ramps. I'm not one of those people who like is like a ramp hater or anything, but the price of the ramps at my Sunday market at Tompkins Square, they were $6 a bunch. Wow. I mean, Union Square, they were $3 a bunch, but still, that's like...
They're not that different from other alliums of, you know, I don't know, scallion.
Well, they're sharper.
Yeah.
Stinkier. They've got that funkiness. They've got that sliminess. You know, there's...
Years ago, I did a cookbook with Gray Kunz called The Elements of Taste. And in my front yard in Brooklyn, like this little border of, you know, ivy kind of thing, I'm looking out one day, this time of year, when ramps were in, and I see a bunch of morels in my front yard.
Here?
Yeah, in Brooklyn. And I went, well, Gray's a big mushroom guy. And I said, Gray, are these morels? And he said, because I didn't want to be eating things that I thought were morels that weren't and then be dead now. And Gray said, yeah. So we had Brooklyn morels and ramps for 1 year. And every year I go back to that little corner of... But I think probably the wrong dogs have been stopping there, so... My morel farm is gone.
That's one of the beauties of, you know, the spontaneity of wild edibles. It comes and it goes. So, quick question. Say you're trying to cook for a date. You're cooking to seduce. What would you make? Meehan.
Oh, man. Start with Kaminsky.
Kaminsky.
He's the seduction
artist. Oh, steak with LSD.
I'll go steak with pot butter.
Pot butter?
If he's using
with a nice little, yeah. Well,
That's a good, I have no idea. Well, I've never seduced anybody. That I can recall. No, I don't know, man. I mean, just great food.
With narcotics.
And good wine.
Okay. Oh, okay, with alcohol. That's always, yeah. I hear that a lot, you know. Just go for the wine. Skip right to that. Into it. So,
boy, so we really cut off a whole line of conversation here. That
no.
Yeah, did we both just think of steak? That's so sad.
How about food to turn women off?
See, anything Fergus Hendrick, yeah.
Yeah, durian borscht.
What's your favorite recipe from both of these cookbooks, Momofuku or Seven Fires? You have a favorite?
Well, boy, we're wearing a groove here, but the steak. Doing the perfect steak. I mean, we worked so hard on that to get it exactly right. So, he's got this splayed chicken with a split at the breast, not at the backbone, and crushed, and then a paste sort of garlic and rosemary and underneath and on top of under the skin and on top of it and on both sides. And then with a lemon peel confit, sort of, which is just lemon peel and olive oil that you've cooked, pressed into the skin. And you grill that for about 15 minutes aside. And I guess I cheat a little bit. I use my version of Thomas Keller's brine, which I use sugar, salt, honey, and bay leaf to the chicken for about 6 hours before. Yeah.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. Chicken. Yeah. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, there's a... I mean, I make a lot of those recipes, but there's a pork sausage, like spicy pork sausage over rice cakes in the sambar section. And I typically make it without rice cakes, with noodles and like mix up the meat. But it's like a Sichuan style thing with a bunch of creamy tofu
that
in at the end.
Good. Yeah.
And you can kind of vary the formula to whatever you can.
Two more. I want to
stop.
Well, there's one that's like you sort of pound down a pork loin and you you confit some orange peel, and you press that and some thyme, maybe a little bit of a brown sugar into it. That's pretty awesome.
That sounds good. I remember seeing that. Yeah.
And similarly, oranges. Just peel an orange, half of it. Melt some brown sugar on a griddle outside. Put some sugar on the orange, and then some rosemary. Put that on the grill, and when the sugar turns black, take it off, and the orange will have cooked in stages, and like with some mascarpone or creme fraiche, Malto, Godot.
That sounds amazing.
That sounds amazing. Well, hopefully some fodder for your upcoming barbecues, if it gets nice enough ever. It seems to be getting there. But unfortunately, that's about all the time we have today. Thanks so much for coming, guys.
Thanks for having
us on. Thank you, Kathy. You're the best.
Totally. Thank you. I mean, what am I saying? Yeah. You guys are the best.
No, you're the best.
I'm the best?
You haven't even plugged your book this show. Can we get a plug in for your book?
It's called The Art of Eating In, How I Learned to Stop Spending and Love the Stove. I think people know that pretty well.
They don't know it well enough. It needs to be on everyone's lips all
the time. Do their moms know that? Do their moms have it on their nightstand is the question.
Well, actually, a friend's mom, Natasha Mass, actually recently told me that my mom read the book, and I did too. And I was like, what? Is this like some mother-daughter, like, we're both going to read the same book at the same time? I was blown away. That was really cool to hear.
Next stop, Oprah.
We'll see. Thanks again. I'm really excited for your upcoming cookbook about, and I can never remember the name. Culinary Intelligence and Hedonism. And I'm excited for yours too, Peter Meehan. This is Frankie Spatino. When's that coming out? Really soon, right?
June 10, 11, 12.
So in a couple of months. Cool.
Around Flag Day.
All right. Is your band playing anytime soon?
I think we're going to play a book party for that. But we just played on FMU last week, so you can go and check it out in the FMU archives.
Great. And it's called your band?
Spectre Folk.
Nice. Good stuff. I saw this band's the last bit of their set a few weeks ago. Good. Really good stuff. All right. Thanks again. And I'm your host, Kathy Arway. I'd like to thank Jack and Nat and everybody at Heritage Foods. We'll see you next week. Love you.